A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking about something that genuinely rearranged how I think about crime. He's been talking with Simona Weinglass at the Times of Israel, who's done some of the most important investigative work on the Forex and binary options scam ecosystem. And one thing she told him keeps rattling around in my head. Those call centers that defraud retirees out of their savings, the ones that look like boiler room operations run by guys in bad suits, when you trace them far enough, they share infrastructure with human trafficking networks, same logistics, same shell companies, same money laundering channels.
That's the thing that doesn't get reported enough. We have this mental filing system where white-collar fraud lives in one drawer and organized crime lives in another, and never the twain shall meet. But the people who actually trace the money keep finding the same names, the same corporate structures, the same call center floors serving both.
Daniel's question is really about the how. How does a journalist without subpoena power, without police authority, without the ability to freeze a single bank account, how do they trace a scam from a Tel Aviv boiler room to an Eastern European trafficking network? What's the actual toolkit?
The short answer is spreadsheets, patience, and an almost pathological willingness to read corporate registries across six jurisdictions. But the longer answer is what makes this worth an episode. Because the techniques are fascinating, the constraints are brutal, and most of what we think we know about investigative journalism is wrong.
Before we get into the toolkit, though, we should define what we're actually talking about. It's not the black market in the sense of drugs and weapons. It's companies that look legitimate from the outside. Offices in Tel Aviv high-rises, LinkedIn profiles, venture capital pitches, but whose revenue model is deliberately opaque.
And the Forex and binary options sector was the poster child for this before the Knesset banned it in 2017. These were companies that presented themselves as online trading platforms, but the actual business was defrauding retail investors, often retirees, often in Europe and North America, out of billions of dollars collectively. The sales floors looked like any other tech company's call center, except the script was designed to extract maximum deposits and then make it functionally impossible to withdraw funds.
The gray economy is this space where the company has a website, a corporate registration, maybe even a glossy office, but the product doesn't actually exist, or it exists only as a mechanism for extracting money. The revenue isn't from trading commissions, it's from losses disguised as trades.
Here's where Simona Weinglass's work becomes so important. She documented something that most coverage missed entirely when she traced the ownership and logistics of these operations, following the money through shell companies in Cyprus, cross-referencing directors across jurisdictions. She kept finding connections to Eastern European organized crime networks. The same infrastructure that laundered money for binary options fraud was being used for human trafficking proceeds. Same call center logistics, same document forgery services, same money laundering conduits.
Which is the thing that should make us uncomfortable. We want to believe that the guy running a fraudulent trading platform is a different species from the guy running a trafficking ring. One is a white-collar criminal who'd never get his hands dirty. The other is something darker, but the paper trail doesn't respect that distinction.
That's what makes the journalistic challenge so interesting. How do you prove that connection when you can't compel testimony, you can't subpoena bank records, and the people involved are actively threatening you with libel suits? The answer involves some creative investigative tradecraft and a lot of time spent in corporate registries that most people don't even know exist. Let's get into the actual mechanics. The first thing to understand is that corporate registries are the investigative journalist's equivalent of a police database. Except they're public, they're scattered across dozens of countries, and nobody standardizes the formatting. I'm serious. Israel's corporate registry, the Rasham HaChevrot, is publicly searchable. You can look up any registered company, see who the directors are, when it was incorporated, whether it's filed annual reports. It's not glamorous. It's a government website that looks like it was designed during the Oslo Accords. but is the starting point for almost everything.
If I'm a journalist and I want to trace a binary options operation, I start by identifying the Israeli company behind the trading platform, which is usually buried somewhere in the fine print of a website, and then I pull up its registration.
And then you look at the directors. Who are they? What other companies are they listed as directors of? This is where cross-referencing becomes powerful. You take that name and you run it through the Cyprus company database because Cyprus has been the jurisdiction of choice for Israeli forex operations setting up shell companies. Then you check UK Companies House because a surprising number of these operations route through London registered entities for the veneer of legitimacy. Then Belize, the British Virgin Islands, sometimes Panama.
You're doing all of this without anyone being legally required to answer a single question.
And that's the fundamental asymmetry. A police investigator can freeze accounts, execute search warrants, compel testimony. A journalist has none of that. What they do have is the fact that people who register shell companies are often lazy or sloppy. They reuse the same notary, the same nominee director service, the same physical address across multiple entities. When you see the same office address in Nicosia appearing on the registration documents of 8 different companies, all of which trace back to binary options, operations in Tel Aviv. You found a node in the network.
The sloppiness is the exploit.
It's the entire exploit. And then there are the leaked databases. The Panama Papers in 2016, the offshore leaks database from the ICIJ. These are troves of beneficial ownership information that let journalists pierce the shell company veil. A company might list a nominee director in Cyprus, but the leaked records from Mossack Fonseca show who actually controls it. That's how you go from a generic-looking trading platform to a specific individual with documented ties to, say, a Georgian organized crime figure.
Which brings us to the human side of this, because corporate registries and leaked databases will only get you so far. At some point, you need someone on the inside.
This is where the craft gets delicate. Weinlass and journalists like her cultivate sources inside these operations. Former employees who left because they couldn't stomach what they were doing, disgruntled affiliates who got cheated out of commissions, sometimes victims who become amateur investigators themselves. The challenge is that these people are terrified. They've seen what happens to people who talk.
How do you verify someone who's afraid for their life and won't even give you their real name?
The source tells you something that should leave a paper trail. A specific transaction, a specific date, a specific corporate filing, and you go verify it independently. If the document exists and matches what they described, that builds credibility. You do this repeatedly, across multiple claims, until you've established that the source knows what they're talking about. It's slow. It can take months to build enough trust and verification to use a single source in a story.
All of this communication is happening over encrypted channels. Signal, TailsOS, burner phones.
Because the threat isn't theoretical. These operations have private investigators. They run digital surveillance on journalists who are getting too close. If you're storing source identities in the same place as your evidence, you're creating a single point of failure that could expose everyone. The operational security protocols are intense. Separate devices, air gap storage, dead drops for physical documents. It's espionage tradecraft applied to financial journalism.
Which makes sense when you consider what's actually being uncovered. The Wolves of Tel Aviv investigation wasn't just about fraudulent trading platforms. Weinglass documented that the call center infrastructure, the physical offices, the phone systems, the sales scripts, the payment processing, was shared between binary options, fraud, and human trafficking operations. The same logistics network serving both.
That's the thing that should reframe how we think about organized crime. The division between white-collar and violent crime is an administrative convenience, not a natural boundary. The call center that defrauds a retiree in Manchester on Tuesday can process payments for a trafficking ring on Thursday. The shell company in Cyprus that launders forex scam proceeds can also launder ransom payments. The infrastructure is fungible.
The investigative journalist's job is essentially to trace the pipes. Not just the crimes, but the shared logistics layer that makes all of it possible.
Finding the pipes is only half the battle. The harder question is what you can actually do with what you found. Because a lot of these stories never see publication.
Even when they're true.
Especially when they're true. Truth is not a complete defense in every jurisdiction, and Israel's libel laws are among the most plaintiff-friendly in the democratic world. You can have documents, you can have sources, you can have everything lined up and still get sued into silence.
Walk me through that. I've got a story. I'd traced a call center to a trafficking network. I've got corporate records, corroborated sources, the works. Why can't I publish?
Because the standard for winning a libel case isn't whether the reporting is factually accurate. It's whether you can prove it in court, under cross-examination, with your sources exposed. Pre-trial discovery in Israel can compel a journalist to reveal every source, every document, every communication. So the fraud operator doesn't need to win the case. They just need to file it. The moment discovery starts, your sources are burned. People who trusted you with their safety are now named in court filings.
The lawsuit itself is the weapon, not the verdict.
That's the entire logic of a slap suit. Strategic lawsuit against public participation. The goal isn't to prove you wrong. It's to make the process so expensive, so draining, and so dangerous to your sources that you kill the story yourself. And it works. Weinglass has talked about stories that took years to verify before they could be published, not because the facts were unclear, but because the legal scaffolding had to be unassailable.
Which means what exactly? How do you structure a story to survive that?
You build it on public records. Not leaked documents alone, not source testimony alone, public records that anyone can pull. Corporate registrations, court filings, regulatory actions, you triangulate everything. If a source tells you something, you don't publish until you found the same fact in at least two independent public documents. You also avoid the single source claim wherever possible. Every assertion in the story should be something you could defend in court without ever naming a confidential source.
That sounds like it takes forever.
And some stories still don't make it. I know of cases, not just in Israel, where a journalist had the whole thing mapped out, corporate chains, beneficiary ownership, the works, and then got served with a libel suit in a jurisdiction where pre-trial discovery would have exposed everything. The story died. Not because it was wrong, because publishing it would have destroyed the people who helped build it.
Which brings us to the physical side of this. Because it's not just lawsuits.
And the intimidation is different from what you'd expect with traditional organized crime reporting. When you're covering a mafia operation, the threats tend to be overt. Someone shows up at your door, or your car gets tampered with. The financial fraud networks are more subtle. Private investigators tailing you. Digital surveillance on your devices. Reputation attacks. Suddenly, there are anonymous posts calling you a fraud, a fabricator, someone with an agenda. The goal is to make you seem unreliable before you ever publish.
Death by a thousand credibility cuts.
It's effective because it's deniable. A private investigator following a journalist isn't illegal in most places. Posting anonymous smears isn't illegal. But the cumulative effect is that you're constantly looking over your shoulder, constantly second-guessing your security, constantly wondering if your sources have been compromised. That's why the operational security protocols are so intense. Signal for all communications. Tails OS for any research that could be traced. Burner phones for source contact. Dead drops for physical documents. And the cardinal rule, source identities and evidence are never stored in the same place.
If someone seizes your laptop, they get documents, but not names. If they compromise your phone, they get names, but not documents.
It's compartmentalization, the same principle intelligence agencies use. And it's not paranoia. Journalists covering these networks have had their devices compromised. They've had their travel monitored. The threat is real, and it's constant.
What does this tell us about the broader economy of fraud, though? Beyond Israel, beyond binary options. If the line between white-collar and organized crime is this blurry in one jurisdiction, it's probably blurry everywhere. The structural conditions are similar.
That's the second-order implication that I think is underappreciated. The structural conditions that enabled this in Israel. Aggressive sales culture normalized in the tech sector, weak cross-border regulatory coordination, the ease of incorporating shell companies in places like Cyprus and Belize. Those conditions aren't unique. You see versions of the same dynamic in the UK, where Companies House has been criticized for years for allowing fraudulent entities to register with minimal oversight. You see it in Cyprus, which has spent decades positioning itself as a jurisdiction where corporate opacity is a feature, not a bug.
Jurisdictional arbitrage as a business model.
The criminals understand this better than the regulators do. If incorporating in Israel creates too much exposure, you incorporate in Cyprus. If Cyprus tightens up, you move to Belize. The regulatory patchwork isn't a barrier, it's the terrain. The fraud networks are multinational by design, while law enforcement is still organized around national borders.
The investigative journalist isn't just tracing a crime. They're tracing an entire parallel infrastructure that exists specifically because the legal system isn't designed to see it. If I'm hearing this right, and I think Daniel was circling the same thing, there are really two audiences for what we've been describing. The person who wants to do this work, and the person who wants to know whether the investigative journalism they're reading is any good. And the advice for both starts from the same place.
Not in the personal finance sense. I mean the ability to read a corporate registry filing and understand what you're looking at. Who are the directors? What's the share structure? Is there a nominee shareholder arrangement that obscures beneficial ownership? If you can't parse a balance sheet, you can't trace a money laundering operation through shell companies. The paper trail is written in accounting.
Which is not what most journalism programs teach.
It's not what most journalists know. The skill stack for this kind of reporting is interdisciplinary. Some accounting, some corporate law, enough OSINT proficiency to cross-reference entities across six jurisdictions, and the legal knowledge to understand what you can safely publish. Plus the patience to follow a paper trail for years.
For the rest of us, the readers, there are actually pretty clear signals for whether an investigative piece is solid or whether it's just dramatic. First one, sourcing depth. Is the reporter relying on anonymous claims? Or are there multiple corroborating sources? Documents, public records, named individuals. If every explosive claim is attributed to a source close to the investigation, you're reading speculation dressed as reporting.
The second signal is jurisdictional cross-referencing. Does the reporter connect entities across different countries' registries, or are they working entirely within one jurisdiction? The best financial investigations are inherently multinational, because the fraud networks are. If a story about a Cyprus-registered company never mentions the Cyprus corporate registry, something's missing.
The third one, which I hadn't thought about before this conversation, is whether the reporter has visibly addressed the legal defensibility of their claims. Are they leaning on public records that anyone can pull, or are they relying on leaked documents that they can't verify independently? The former is publishable, the latter is vulnerable.
Which brings us to the broader thing that I think Daniel was really getting at. The categories we use to understand crime, white-collar versus organized, financial versus violent, are administrative conveniences. They're filing systems. They're not natural kinds. The most dangerous operations are hybrids that share infrastructure across everything from binary options, fraud, to human trafficking. The call center doesn't care what the money is from.
The pipes are the same. We just label the water differently. Here's what I keep coming back to. And I think it's the question Daniel never got to ask. All of these techniques, the corporate registries, the shell company tracing, the source cultivation over encrypted channels, they depend on a world where crime leaves a paper trail. What happens when it doesn't?
This is the thing that keeps me up. The next generation of financial fraud is already moving onto rails that don't generate the kind of records we've been describing. DeFi rug pulls. You launch a token, hype it, drain the liquidity pool, and vanish. The entire operation exists as blockchain transactions and Discord messages. There's no corporate registry to search because there's no corporation.
No Cypriot shell company, no nominee director, no Mossack Fonseca leak to pierce the veil.
Just wallet addresses and synthetic identities. And synthetic doesn't mean fake in the crude sense, it means generated. AI-created personas with consistent backstories, LinkedIn profiles, GitHub histories. The journalist who tries to trace a 2028 fraud ring isn't going to find a paper trail. They're going to find a procedurally generated ghost.
The toolkit we just spent an episode describing has an expiration date.
Parts of it do. The OSINT techniques for tracing corporate structures will still work for the fraud that operates in the legacy economy. But the cutting edge of financial crime is moving to infrastructure that was designed, in part, to be jurisdictionally illegible. And investigative journalism doesn't yet have a good answer for that.
Which is unsettling. But it also clarifies something about what the best investigative reporting actually is. It's not glamorous. The public sees the headline, the exposé, the moment of revelation. But the work itself looks like accounting. It looks like data analysis and patient relationship, building and reading thousands of pages of corporate filings in languages you barely speak.
The glamour is in the reveal, the work is in the spreadsheet, and the encrypted message.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, British Somaliland exported a vibrant crimson dye made from the dried bodies of the Kermes insect, a relative of cochineal, which local harvesters collected from acacia trees and sold to textile traders in Berbera.
The question we're left with is whether the next Simon a Wineglass will be an accountant who learned journalism or a journalist who learned to read a blockchain. Either way, the work is going to look stranger than we expect. This has been my Weird Prompts, with thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to dig deeper into any of this, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Until then, read the footnotes.
They're where the story actually lives.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.